What's up, everybody? Welcome into the Euro Snob Podcast. My name is Ian Smith, joined here tonight by Alex John. Alex, how's everything doing down there in Florida?
I can't complain. Things are pretty good down here in sunny Florida. How about up there in New York?
Dude, it's been, the weather's been fantastic. We've had like 590 degree days already this month. It's on pace to be the hottest July ever up here, and I love every second of it.
And I hear there's some kind of soccer tournament going on this summer. I don't know if you know anything about that.
I don't know what you're talking about. there's some sort of rumbles about England and bringing something home, and I don't know what the hell they were talking about, but there, those, whatever it was, those dreams got smashed the other day.
Apparently didn't get home in time, right?
Well, you know what, quite frankly, that's what you get for loading your team full of Spurs and Liverpool players.
I know, when the going gets tough, Spurs usually get going. But
yeah, pretty much. And that's exactly what happened.
But, in all seriousness, just kind of getting right into the finals preview. I know we haven't been on for a little while, but safe to say all of my predictions were completely wrong. I'm pretty sure I predicted something like Brazil versus Portugal, and that went horribly wrong. So nothing about this preview might be accurate. But
hey, I had France as one of my teams, but that's about it. But I'm also not on record saying that.
See, the funny thing about Croatia is every tournament before this, I predicted them to go far as a dark horse. And then the one time I don't is the one time they do. So just get right into it. Croatia coming off of three extra time games, France coming in with an extra day's rest and not having played extra time. Just what are your kind of keys to this final? I think a lot of people like yourself did think France was going to get here just with the depth of talent they had, the squad they had, the firepower and the attack that they had. Croatia was one of those where people thought they could do some damage with the right draw, but not necessarily one of the tournament favorites. What's kind of been your impressions of each team getting to this point and how they've looked?
I think that it's really been polar opposites for both squads. It's kind of crazy that France is in the finals, and I really don't think they've had to really kick it into gear yet. I mean, sure, Belgium gave them a pretty tough test, but in the end, I felt like they were pretty comfortable in that game. I don't know that they've really been put under too much pressure. I don't think we've seen the best that they have to offer because I think they're that good. Croatia, it's exact opposite. I mean, you mentioned it in your lead-in that it's been three straight extra time games for them. They've played a game and a half. Well, I'm sorry, whatever it is, a full game extra over the course of the last week in those three games, a week and a half. It's crazy really the amount that they've played, but in my opinion, they look like the fresher side there in the extra time against England. So it's kind of, it's really two completely different roads to get to this point. And I think it's going to make for an interesting final because France has yet to really be tested. And yeah, like I said, Belgium really kind of gave them a run, but they've yet to be tested fully, in my opinion. And Croatia's not backing down. They're coming at them.
Yeah. The funny thing about France is I was thinking the same thing as you about like how they got tested against Belgium to some extent. And when I watched that game initially, I thought, wow, Belgium kind of controlled the game at certain points. And then I actually looked at the stats. And France had 16 shots, Belgium had six. Belgium really didn't create tons from open play in terms of clear-cut chances. So it kind of speaks to the French defense and how people undersold them. But then you look at who they're starting. They're starting a Barcelona player in Umtiti and a Real Madrid player in Varane. And all of a sudden it makes sense why they've been able to shut teams down. I mean, those are two of the best young center backs in the world. That midfield with Kante and Pogba and Matuidi has really been clicking. I mean, Kante's just on another planet right now in terms of being a pure defensive midfielder. Pogba's played as well as people, hoped he could. But at the same time, like you said, I still think there's another level he can go to in this tournament. And in the attack, Griezmann and Giroud really haven't been anything special. All things considered, Mbappe's kind of carried the load in terms of that front three. So they really haven't had to click it. And so it's going to be interesting when they come up against a really battle-tested Croatia team Croatia doesn't necessarily have the depth that France has. You know, France can bring on an Ousmane Dembele and Lamar and Tolisso and Fekir off the bench. I mean, it's kind of freaky when you actually say the names out loud. You know, Croatia doesn't necessarily have those types of options, but to come back from a goal down in, you know, in, I think it's either the last two or the last three games, either way, is pretty remarkable, because they didn't look great against Denmark. They kind of scraped by against Russia, and then against England, they really only turned it on in the second half. So they're one of those teams that finds a way to win. So it's like conventional logic is telling you that France should kind of kick it into second gear and be able to take that. But I mean, is it just me, or do you have that gnawing feeling as well that Croatia might be able to pull a little bit of an upset?
I don't know. I was kind of it's funny because I was talking about it with my boss, my CEO earlier today, and in the lunchroom, and he was asking about the game, and I said, France, no problem, you know, all day. And he said, okay. He's like, you want to make a bet? Cause I think Croatia is going to do it. And I kind of backed off it. It's kind of like, well, you know what? Let me sleep on this. Because I was super confident with France coming in. Like, they were really my pick, because like you talk about their depth, you talk about their skill, just listen to the names. Like, they have an incredible team. But there's just something about them that, again, I don't know if it's because they haven't been forced to play a full 90. It just makes me a little uneasy. You know, there were times where they had to kick it in gear, and they did, and they kind of pulled out and did what they need to do to get it done, which is kind of what Croatia's done. But Croatia, they've really scraped by. You know, that's, I think you put it really well, that they've scraped through to get to the point where they are now. I have a hard time seeing that they're going to have enough to get it done. I mean, I think they have more of a, I don't want to say passion because it's the World Cup final, but there's a certain spirit about that team that we've seen throughout the entire tournament, and we've yet to really see from France. So for me, it comes down to a question of when France is really tested, can they kick that in gear? I'm pretty confident that the more I think about it, that they will be able to. And I don't want to say it's going to be a boring final, but I could certainly see France going, you know, winning it comfortably. I think if Croatia's got to hope for extra time again.
Yeah, I think the other thing is, you would think France has kind of learned the lesson from 2 years ago in the Euro final, when they went in heavily favored against Portugal. Ronaldo went out within like, what, 30, 35 minutes, something like that. And France never really took it to that next level. They never really put the game away, and they left that opening for Portugal to come in and steal it in extra time. So, you know, I'm thinking they probably learned something from that. But at the same time, every time you count this Croatia team out, their big names step up. You know, in the last game, it was Mandzukic and Perisic who really kind of took over the game. And obviously, Rakitic and Modric in midfield. You know, the matchup that I'm really, really curious to see, just in terms of the contrast in styles, is that midfield battle, because they both play basically what amounts to a midfield three. You know, Kante, Pogba, and Matuidi, usually the France three, and then Rakitic, Modric, and in the last match, it was Brozovic, the Inter Milan player in that midfield. I mean, looking at that specific aspect of the game, where do you kind of lean to that battle unfolding? I mean, for me, in terms of being able to control a game, there's nobody better than Luka Modric. I mean, he almost plays the role of an entire midfield on his own.
It's really kind of, I'm glad you brought that up, because it's such a dichotomy when you look at the difference between those two midfielders. I mean, Modric and Rakitic versus Pogba and Matuidi and Kante. Like, you're talking on France, it's exuberance, it's strength, it's energy, it's pace. And on the Croatian side, it's technical ability. It's more about that. It's more about ball playing. It's more about passing and moving, when, you know, as opposed to the French. And it's going to be such an interesting battle in there. I mean, and I'm not trying to take anything away from the technical ability of the French midfielders, because Pogba is one of the best, and he's, I think, going to be the key. Kante is going to run around all the time, and he's going to break plays up, and he's going to make it really difficult on that technical players in the Croatian midfield, but they're going to need somebody. The French are going to need somebody to settle that midfield down and take control technically. And that's really going to come down to Pogba. So I think in that matchup there in the midfield, he's going to be the deciding factor. Just because if he doesn't do enough technically and on the ball, they're going to get there. I think the midfield edge goes to Croatia. And that's, quite frankly, that's where this game is going to be won or lost.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. And I think Matuidi is kind of the one that I'm not sure what purpose he serves necessarily. You know, he's an extra pair of legs. He's got great energy, but he's not necessarily a great passer. And so I think, you know, if Croatia is going to have a chance, they need to really be able to dominate the ball without being passive on the ball. And I think you and I could speak to that as Arsenal fans, where we would dominate possession, turn it over quick, get countered on and score and get scored on. And with Mbappe and Griezmann, especially, that is a real, real risk for Croatia. And kind of something that I think France might try to exploit is, if you noticed in the first half, at least England kind of hit long balls over the top to Sterling, and Sterling was running the channels and really kind of dragging Lovren and Vida all over the place. They stopped doing that in the second half, but I think, you know, with a player like Mbappe, it really does give you that option to just kind of, you know, launch him on, you know, with a long ball or, you know, a ball into the corners, into the channels, and let his pace kind of take control, because you know that the Croatian defenders obviously are going to come in with a little bit of fatigue. That's kind of the avenue I could see France using. And, you know, obviously the aerial presence of Giroud opens things up for everyone else. I'm struggling to see how Croatia are going to create a lot of chances in the attacking third, though. You know, I know they can manipulate the ball, and Perisic did have a good second half against England. But, you know, it might be one of those things where they're only going to get two or three chances, and they really got to kind of capitalize on that, because that's all they're going to get.
Yeah, I'd agree with you there. And that's, again, where I think the midfield comes in, because so many of Croatia's chances, are generated through Luka Modric and Ivan Rakitic. So if Conte and Matuidi, if they're able to, you know, take them out of the game to some extent, that's going to really limit what Croatia can generate. I mean, they don't have the, you know, Perisic can bring it from time to time, but they really don't have the one single player that is going to generate something out of nothing. Like Mandzukic is a good finisher, but he's not a creator. Perisic is probably the one guy as far as their forwards that can create on his own. France, on the other hand, I mean, between Griezmann and Mbappe, those two are, you know, they can generate plenty of chances on their own just by lobbing the ball forward and letting the two of them go to work. So I think that it's going to be a really, again, it's where I come back to. I mean, can Conte and Matuidi, can they take that, you know, can they cut that service off that comes from that midfield?
And it's interesting because, you know, Rakitic especially, he's one of those players who doesn't necessarily look like he's controlling a game, but then you see him pop up in spaces. He knows how to read space. He knows how to play between the lines. And then Modric, with his range of passing, it really does open up the game for Croatia. So, you know, I am curious to see that. I don't think that Croatia's fullbacks are going to be able to get forward nearly as much against France as they did against England. And I think Croatia being able to do that against England is ultimately what won them that game. And, you know, we can kind of get into the England part later. But, you know, I just think that Croatian back line is going to have some problems. I don't necessarily think that they will be able to cope with France's interchanging of positions and speed and on the break and technical ability on the break. So let's get a prediction from you on that one. Where do you think the World Cup is going?
I think it's going to France relatively comfortably, maybe 3-1. Giroud is going to finally put a chance away. And that's one thing really for France, is that he's such a streaky finisher that if he decides to get hot on Sunday, I mean, he can single-handedly bury a couple chances and put Croatia out. So I think France just has too much firepower. I think they're too athletic in midfield. I think they're going to really use that athleticism to smother the midfield creativeness from Croatia and make it super difficult. Now, that doesn't mean Croatia can't catch them out. And it doesn't mean that, you know, like I said before, France hasn't had to really step it up for a whole game yet. And you brought up the Euros. They showed that they weren't prepared to do that at the Euros. And that was only 2 years ago. So the question comes down to, is France able to step it up in the moment when they need to? If they can't, it's going to go to Croatia. I think personally that they will, but it's going to be really interesting. So 3-1 France, in my opinion.
Yeah, I think France wins. I really want to pick Croatia. I love their midfield players, but I got France 2-1. I think Mbappe and Griezmann score for France, and I think Mandzukic probably gets a late consolation goal for Croatia. I just think France has too much depth on the bench, too much speed in their attack, and that extra day of rest plus, you know, the extra time that Croatia had, I think it just is going to add up. But overall, I mean, I think it's been a really good World Cup so far. I mean, what have kind of been your general impressions as to the quality of play, the types of games we've seen, the amount of goals, things of that nature?
I mean, other than CONCACAF teams, it's been some pretty impressive soccer being played. It's been a lot of open attacking minded soccer. I feel like I don't know the numbers, but I feel like we've seen a lot of goals. There's been a lot of set piece goals, which, you know, take that as you will. I mean, whether that's poor defending or good execution on the set pieces, but there's also been a shit ton of stoppage time goals. You also haven't seen too many teams. I don't think there's been any. I mean, there's been a couple players sent off, but nothing for violent tackles. When you compare that to previous years, I want to say there's 6 or 7 at least in each of the last 3 World Cups where there's been bad tackles with guys sent off. And I think that makes a big difference too with the quality of play, because you're not seeing teams getting, you know, going down a man in games, getting put away early. So the competitiveness overall of this World Cup has been pretty impressive. Teams are never out of it, and that just makes it, you know, so much more exciting.
Yeah, there really haven't been many blowout games, you know, at least in the games that mattered. I mean, obviously, yeah, you saw the game where Panama got killed by England. But other than that, there really haven't been games where I thought this is completely one-sided and this is boring. I think, you know, the quality of play in international football is a lot different than club football, just based on the resources available, obviously, to each country versus what a club might have. I think VAR, for the most part, has gone pretty well. I think there's been a few instances where I thought it should have been used to clear up some decisions, but for the most part, it's gotten some wrong decisions right. Ultimately, it's a tool. It's just an extra tool available to a referee. What the referee interprets from getting a second look at something is up to them. But I think that's kind of been a positive element to come out of this. There's been some young talent that we've seen emerge, and we can kind of get into some of those names later. But, you know, since we do talk Arsenal, obviously we do watch a lot of the English national team. Just kind of quickly, what have been your takeaways from them? Because to me, I'm mixed, because yes, they did get to a semifinal, and you can only play the teams that are in front of you, and I get that, but they beat Tunisia late. They beat a really awful Panama team. Their B team lost to Belgium's B team. They beat Colombia on penalties, and Colombia didn't have James Rodriguez. And then they beat Sweden. So how much of a step forward do you think it is for English football? Because obviously you can grow from the confidence of getting to a semifinal, and you can't understate that. And I don't want anyone to think I'm disrespecting England, because my country didn't get to the World Cup at all. So what right do I have to say anything about anyone else? But I mean, I think the it's coming home thing kind of started as a joke. And then as they got further, their fans almost thought, okay, this might actually happen.
Yeah. It's kind of, for me at least, it's exactly the way I expected that English team to exactly the way I expected that English team to play and everything to kind of fall out. Harry Kane scored a lot of goals, but a lot of them were tap-ins and PKs. Raheem Sterling had a ton of, you know, created a ton of chances, but had no end product. They're good on set pieces. They were impressive at times, but when it really got difficult, they had, you know, they really struggled. I mean, look at the Croatia game. Croatia scored the tying goal in the second half, and England was incredibly lucky not to ship off another goal and not even make it to extra time. And they were that second half, they were under pressure completely, and they just couldn't get, you know, their heads right to figure out what was going on. I mean, it was really to script what I thought was going to happen. Quite frankly, I thought that Eric Dier was going to miss the PK in the round previous because, you know, Spurs.
even a blind squirrel finds a nut, right?
Yeah, right. Even talking to one of my buddies that, you know, that I play soccer with here, who's from England. He's a Huddersfield guy. So, you know, giving him a hard time, and my buddy who's a Spurs fan, he thought Dier was going to miss. You know, it's certainly promising for them because they were, I believe, what, the second youngest team at the World Cup?
They were the youngest, actually.
Was it the youngest? Nigeria was the youngest, I believe.
Oh, okay.
But regardless, they were one of the youngest three teams at the World Cup, which is really impressive for them. It's disappointing that it wasn't made up of Arsenal players, and if it was, they would have done a lot better. But they chose Spurs players, and they're only going to get you so far. They're going to get you into the top four. They're going to get you into a semifinal, but they're not going to get the job done. I mean, I was saying that the entire tournament, and it just kind of felt it's so cliche, but it's
the problem is, like, they didn't plan to bring any technical midfielders. You know, when Croatia really started bossing that game, you had Lingard and Dele Alli, who, I mean, they're good players, but they're guys who make runs into the box and you know, get
Sterling
on the end
of the field.
Exactly.
Sterling was the one player that was helping settle things down for them, create things for them.
That was ultimately the worst substitution of the entire tournament, all things considered, because Rashford came on and did nothing. Alli and Lingard couldn't cope with the passing and movement of their Croatian midfield, because they're guys who get into the box and try to get on the end of things and score goals. They're not necessarily guys who are going to control a game for you. So, you know, you play a midfield of Lingard, Alli, and Henderson, you're not going to beat a really good team with a good midfield. They didn't play one of those up until the time they played Croatia. And, you know, I think they were only going to get so far. So I think they need to develop that creative type, not necessarily like a true number 10, because that type of player largely doesn't exist anymore. But, you know, at least someone in that mold, you know, Lallana even would have been helpful.
They needed a player like a Luka Modric that can pick a pass from midfield, right? Their creation, they created chances by playing the ball to the wings and playing it back inside. They didn't have that one player that could create through the middle, in my opinion. So if they did have that player, that makes such a huge difference for them. And Dele Alli's not that kind of player. And I think they put him in a position where they relied on him to be that creator, but he's just not that kind of player. And quite frankly, they didn't have the player didn't have any other options really to rely on it. So,
So I think that's got to be their focus moving forward. I mean, there's a good young core they can work with. I thought Kieran Trippier, yes, he's a Spurs player, but my God, he's good. He's
impressive.
Really good.
I was impressed by him.
He might be the best right back in the tournament that I've seen, at least. I mean, he got forward. Every single delivery he had from a cross or set piece was incredible. And kind of transitioning from that, you know, like, who were some of the players that kind of stood out to you, kind of breakout stars, surprise teams, disappointing teams, you know, just kind of general takeaways from the tournament before we transition to some Arsenal talk? Because for me, I'll go first on this one, just because a name came to mind.
I was gonna transfer it on this point right over to that Arsenal talk.
Well, that just
got to. We got a new friend, a new Arsenal friend in town here, a little Uruguayan midfielder.
That's true. It's
who Torreira was for me. It was kind of, I think the other players that stepped up in the tournament, I expected them to. He was really kind of the one player where I was said, where I said, I've never seen you play before, regardless of the fact that he was coming to Arsenal. But I'm like, I've never really seen you play before. And the more and more he played, the more and more I watched him play, the more impressed I was. So for me, he's really the kind of, if you had to put a breakout star on the tournament, for me, that's him. And it's just icing on the cake that he's coming to Arsenal.
What about surprise and disappointment in terms of teams?
In terms of teams, I mean, I'm disappointed personally for Leo Messi in Argentina. I don't have time to go into the way that team was managed, because my God, to not find a way to get Paulo Dybala on the field, and to keep continuously put Meza on the field when you're down a goal instead of Paulo Dybala. I don't have time to go in on Argentina. So I really feel for the players. That was such a poorly managed squad. I feel for Messi. The tournament went to form. I mean, it was a lot of exciting football. I mean, Japan was impressive. You feel for them in the way that they lost against Belgium there, the way they blew that lead. But that was one of the single most exciting halves of football I've ever seen in my life in that game, the Japan-Belgium second half.
That was incredible.
Just up and down. It was incredible.
For me, obviously Torreira stood out, and we'll get into him in just a sec. Irving Lozano for Mexico, I thought he really stood out. In that Germany game, they could not cope. They were just completely lost on how to deal with him. Kimmich couldn't handle him.
I totally forgot about Germany because they were so forgetful, so disappointed.
Germany forgot about Germany.
I completely forgot about that. I forgot they were even in the tournament right there because they were that poor.
I was stunned at how bad they were, honestly.
Oh, and then the fact that they're bringing Yoki Love back. Am I correct? I'm pretty sure saw that. Yeah. They said he was staying. I'm like, that's insane.
I mean, for a country that just won the World Cup to not even make it out of their group, and yes, I understand it happened to Spain last time and Italy the time before.
It's actually quite common, but to go out in the fashion that they went out, I think is kind of...
That's the thing. They didn't even look like they showed up, honestly. You know, that Mexico game, they almost looked surprised that a team came at them, and Mexico just, you know, showed no fear. Lozano and Hernandez and Vela really just kind of picked them apart on the counter, and honestly, that game could have been 4-5-0 Mexico, and it wouldn't have flattered them at all. You know, they got the late winning goal against Sweden. And truthfully, they were awful in that game. They had a chance, against South Korea. Ozil puts it on a plate for Hummels. Hummels skies it over, and that's pretty much all she wrote there. So they're definitely my disappointing team. Surprise team, I'd probably say Japan, just because I didn't think that they were going to get out of that group. Major props to them. I had picked Senegal, I think, to get out of that group. So that was really impressed. I was impressed with Japan. Other than that, everything kind of went to form. I mean, Spain went out a little bit earlier than I expected. Same with Portugal. I think I had them going a little bit further. So, you know.
Yeah, you had Portugal going all the way. So
I don't know. In hindsight, I just thought with Ronaldo and the form he was in, that the rest of his team would kind of be able to rise to his level. But obviously, speaking of Ronaldo, if you've been living under a rock for the past week, it must be like the fucking Grand Canyon. But the thing that I didn't think was going to happen happened. Ronaldo just moved to Juventus. First of all, my initial takeaway is, wow, this is a game changer for Serie A. Yes, I realize he's 33. He's still one of the top two players in the world. He's going to bring a whole new set of eyeballs to the league around the world. This is what that league needed, because now I think Inter and Roma and Milan are forced to invest heavily into their squads. I mean, they've done so already this summer, to be fair, but now, you know, and then Carlo Ancelotti coming to the league, stuff like that. I mean, this, it's a big, big day for Serie A. And it's going to set off some transfer dominoes for the rest of the world, because now Real Madrid has hundreds of millions of pounds of euros, sorry, kind of burning a hole in their pocket. They're going to spend it somewhere. What are kind of your takeaways for that transfer and the dominoes that fall?
Well, my first thought when I saw it happening, it was, how many years in a row have we seen this Ronaldo transfer speculation? And it always ends up with him getting a better contract. I assume that's all it was. I didn't think it was going to be anything more than that. And then all of a sudden, I flip open Twitter and there's Juventus's official Twitter account saying, "Hey, look who we signed." So that was quite a surprise when I saw that happen. But really, what came down to it, and I think, you know, like you said, for that league, for the Italian league, it's going to bring so many eyeballs. You mentioned that, you know, all the other teams like Roma and Inter and Milan and Lazio and the teams that have been really, really quality sides for the last few years now, it's going to show what kind of quality is already in that league. I think there's more there than most people realize, and it's going to continue to show that. And it's going to, like you said, it's going to continue to drive those teams to invest. The more interesting thing is, from a Real standpoint, is I'm surprised that's been their only major outgoing so far. I think that there's, whether, especially with Zidane stepping away, and maybe because it just happened, and, you know, with their new manager stepping in, he just got there. I expected to see quite a bit of turnover this year. You know, players like Benzema on their way out. You need to see them make room for a player like Isco and Asensio. And there's a lot of turnover that needs to happen in that squad. So it'll be interesting to see where they go with the rest of the summer for that, because there could be a few other big names shipped out. The interesting thing for me is the players that are going to be brought in to replace Ronaldo. Now, I've got two names here for you out of the EPL that are going to kind of, you know, to bring this full circle and get a little bit of Arsenal impact on this move, or a little bit of the impact that this move could have on Arsenal. There's two names that I kind of want to throw out there. First one is Eden Hazard, and the second one is Harry Kane. Now, I know Kane just signed the new contract at Tottenham, and I know that Kane has said that he would stay there. But those two players, I think Hazard especially, is a player that he's not going to replace the goals of Ronaldo, but he can create he can replace a lot of the creativeness. He's one of the best dribblers in the world. And a finisher like Kane, which I think we've been saying for a couple of years now, ultimately that's where he was going to end up. I think a player like Christian Eriksen doesn't have a fit there. Real, he's more of a Barcelona fit, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. So, you know, looking at the EPL, and they're going to be looking to make a splash move, to me, those are the names. Had Dele Alli had a better season, or had a big World Cup, I could see him making that move over there. But honestly, I wouldn't be shocked if those are the two names that you saw Real really go after.
And part of my thinking as well is, I don't think Real Madrid would let Ronaldo leave if they didn't have a contingency plan ready. They're the biggest club in the world. You don't just let your best player leave unless you knew something was going down, unless you knew there were two or three guys you can pull. So the two names you mentioned, Hazard and Kane, I think that's, those guys are definitely be on the list. I think Salah, they'll probably try and get Salah. I don't think he's going to move, because I think he just signed an extension. And, you know,
I guess I just don't see him.
He doesn't seem like a Real Madrid type player at this point, just because you haven't necessarily seen it from him for more than a season at this very top level. I saw, you know, on Twitter today, and obviously take that for what it's worth, you know, that Real Madrid had met with some representatives of Neymar. The one issue I see there is that PSG paid, what, $250 million for him? They're going to want at least that much to move him. And he signed a long-term deal. They really have no reason to sell unless they get a crazy, crazy offer. And does Real Madrid really want to shell out $300 million on Neymar when they could probably sign three or four top quality players and probably get the same production and address more needs. And you got to, you know, you do have Gareth Bale there as well. You know, you hope he gets healthy and can replicate what he was. But I think Hazard is the one that feels most like a certainty to me. And then you do, you know, you a guy like Asensio, maybe he gets more run. Maybe you see what he can do as a first choice player. But they need a striker. So if they don't get Harry Kane, do they push for Lewandowski?
That was kind of well. If I was going outside of the EPL, that would be because there's been rumbling to him wanting out at Bayern anyway.
Yeah, and he's always, you know, I think he's had interviews in the past where he mentioned potentially wanting to go to Real Madrid. So, you know, strikers are at a real premium. So if you are getting rid of Benzema, there's only so many names you can look at. And, you know, kind of transitioning to a team that actually doesn't have a striker problem, ironically, is Arsenal, because you have two of the better ones in the world. You have, you know, Aubameyang, who I'd consider a top 10 striker. And then you have Lacazette, who is just in that tier right below that. But, you know, kind of getting into the transfer business for Arsenal real quick, you know, Lucas Torreira is obviously the gem of the summer so far. I mean, you're getting a player at 22 coming from Sampdoria, really about to break out, but you only had to pay 30 million for him. In this market, that's nothing. And you've got a guy that potentially changes your midfield. You know, he played at the base of a diamond in Sampdoria. I'm not exactly sure how they're going to line up with Arsenal. You know, assuming Ramsey stays, you assume Ramsey, Xhaka, Torreira, Ozil are all going to get in there somehow. That's kind of my thinking. So just, you know, kind of a little bit more your take on Torreira, and then we can kind of wrap up on the other signings that Arsenal's made.
Well, Torreira is the exact kind of player we've been crying out for since Francis Coquelin showed up and played a good half season. I mean, actually, quite frankly, we've been asking for a player like that since before that, and we thought, hey, wait a minute, who's this Coquelin guy who showed up and did some good things for 12 games? Torreira not only brings the work rate and defensive ability, but he also brings ability on the ball. He brings the ability to – he's not like Xhaka, where if you press him, he's going to get flustered and lose control. You can't press the ball off of him. He's quick to move the ball. He's good with the ball at his feet. He can dribble past players. He's the player that this midfield has needed for years. The interesting thing is going to be how they set up. I mean, there's a few different things I'm not going to get into today, but is it a 4-3-3? Is it a 4-2-3-1? Do you play a 4-2-2-2 with two central defensive midfielders and two attacking midfielders and rely on your outside backs for width? So there's so many different ways that you can do it, and I'm not sure how Emery's really going to go about it. I think you see Mesut Ozil kind of push more towards a front three forward, where he gets a free reign, where he's not a wide right wing. He's not a winger or a right forward, but he kind of gets to go wherever he wants. And it essentially becomes a, I don't know, 4-3-1-2. I don't know. It's a tie to explain when we start throwing numbers out there, but I'm really curious to see how they set up, but he's the exact player we've needed for a long time.
And I think the encouraging thing is that he fits the profile that I think we should be going for. Young, you know, established at a good club team, but at the same time, not quite a superstar yet, just right on the cusp of breaking out. So you're not paying 60, 70 million to get him. You're paying 20, 30 million to get him and then hoping he breaks out. And that's kind of the type of player you want Sven to be bringing in. Now, I don't know about you. We haven't really talked about this much, but, you know, when Arsenal's first few signings were, you know, Lichtsteiner, Socrates, especially just because of their age, a lot of people were kind of up in arms about that. For me, I completely understood it because I think the plan is get back into the Champions League by using some veteran players, but also ease in younger players. You have an established core. Lichtsteiner feels the need of being that, you know, right back cover because Bellerin played an ungodly amount of games last season. With Lichtsteiner, you're getting experience, you're getting a winner, a guy who's won with Juventus. And Socrates, you needed a veteran center back after Koscielny got hurt. And you had to go for someone. Sven went for someone he was familiar with, who was comfortable with Aubameyang and Mkhitaryan. He's not my favorite player, but I get it. And then with with Leno, I'm going to be honest. I don't know much about him. I've heard he's a great shot stopper, but has lapses of concentration. But we needed an upgrade on Cech because, quite honestly, even if Leno makes a couple mistakes, he can't be worse than Cech. Yeah. And then the final signing we just made yesterday is Matteo Guendouzi. I'm not going to pretend I know anything about him, but I like seeing us go back to that French market, given the types of players France is producing right now. Just kind of your takeaways from those other players and what the transfer strategy seems to you, because from Emery's comments today, we're pretty much done unless something comes available with all these dominoes that fall.
Oh, Dybala.
Dybala, Dembele, one of those two.
Hey, because Juve is going to have to meet FIFA Fair Play stuff, and they're going to have to ship some guys out. It's likely going to be a few of their older players, but fingers crossed, holding out hope that somehow, some way, they make him available. As far as Arsenal's transfer business, it just makes sense. That's the biggest takeaway for me. When you look at it, you put a list up there, what would be the spots you said we needed help coming into this summer? Center back, like goalkeeper, center back, right back, defensive center midfield, and a wide forward. Okay, so we got four of the five. When's the last time that we could say coming into a summer, we need to hit these five spots, and we hit the majority of them? I don't know. I don't know the last time that we were able to say that. So it makes sense, right? You needed veteran, you know, cover at some sort of cover at right back. Lickshiner can still play just because he's old. He's still good. You need a vet, like you said, a veteran influence in center back, with especially with Koscielny going out. Somebody who is going to suit the English game, which I think Socrates is really going to do. He's a physical player. He's an aggressive player. If he can kind of rein in the aggressiveness and go about it in the right way, I think he'll be perfect for the English game. He's good in the air. He's a good ball winner. Defensive midfielder. We talked about Torreira. It's the exact kind of player that we needed for a long time. It's just Leno. I mean, again, I don't know a ton about him. I know he's a good shot stopper. He's extremely quick and extremely athletic. He's very good with the ball at his feet. And yes, he's prone to making some errors, but what he's the exact, I mean, what have we said when we've been watching Petrček? He's just a horrendous shot stopper now. He can't stop the ball. So now we brought in a goalkeeper who's good at, from what I've heard, he's good at commanding his area, and he's a hell of a shot stopper. So the only thing I would have liked is maybe a wide attacking forward.
So that still might happen. That's the thing. I think that's probably the one thing that we might be waiting on. But I'm like you. I'm happy to see business get done early. Torreira, I mean, I'm just really excited to see him play because, like you said, he's not just a ball winner. He's a great passer of the ball, and his game intelligence is right up there with the best in the world. But kind of wrapping things up, because I know we're, you know, kind of winding down, got daddy duty calling you. Yeah, but right. The one thing on Arsenal Twitter this week that I've noticed is, you know, there's been a lot of videos released from training. Some people are saying, oh man, you know, we didn't do this under Wenger. We didn't do that under Wenger. First of all, Wenger's gone. Let's not focus on that anymore. But what have kind of been your takeaways from the training videos? I mean, are people reading too much into it when they're seeing these drills, or are you seeing a noticeable change in terms of the intensity of the training and the atmosphere?
It's all good PR. That's it. It's good PR. I mean, yeah, there's a change. There's going to be a change. There's going to be fresh excitement at the club, but that's all it is. PR. So I don't take it. I don't take anything away from it. We'll see what happens when they hit the pitch.
Yeah, we got a preseason game on Saturday, so that'll be interesting to check out. But yeah, I'm just curious to see, you know, how we kind of experiment with formations moving forward, what types of players we are going to thrive. You know, are we going to see an Ainsley Maitland-Niles get some run with the team? You know, where does Mkhitaryan fit in all of this? Do you find a way to play Aubameyang and Lacazette together? Because it's hard to bench either one of them, and you don't want to push them out wide. I will say everything that Emery's done to this point has really impressed me. you know, learning the language, being able to communicate honestly, the types of transfer moves we've made. So I'm fully on board with where things are going right now. You know, certainly we'll do another one of these as the transfer window winds down and the season's about ready to start, do a little season preview. But, you know, Ian, any final thoughts, World Cup wise, Arsenal wise, things you're looking out for?
At this point in time, I'm just looking forward to a hell of a World Cup final on Sunday and still holding out hope that Arsenal can bring in another guy. But hey, if that's their business is done, their business is done. And I can't wait for the season to get going.
Yeah, same. It should be a hell of a final, and then you're going to see some crazy transfer dominoes start falling probably on Monday, honestly. And it wouldn't.
Yeah, next week's going to be a huge week for that.
Because if you remember, the English window closes a little bit earlier than all the other ones in terms of buying players, so English clubs are going to have to act quick. But yeah, we'll try to get something to you guys over the next couple weeks, obviously depending on how schedules work out. But as always, you can find me on Twitter at UFGoonerAJ. You can find Ian at GunnersFan6. Find the pod at EuroSnobPod. All those are on Twitter. On Facebook, facebook.com/EuroSnobPod. Check us out on iTunes or Podomatic. And we will see you guys over the next couple weeks.
Yeah, enjoy the World Cup final, guys. It's good to talk to you. And like Alex said, we'll be back soon.